from the P-Pickin' Studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another super sweet hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Which garden goodie is the earliest major crop you can grow? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll help you enjoy your very own snow peas, snap peas, and or English shelling peas. Plus your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and outlandishly optimistic oratories. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens, all coming up faster than you being the first on your block to snap some peas.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John on the blend today.
Bob Dereau composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Step an antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY for 30 years.
From the spring-blooming studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for yet another hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we reveal what might be the real reason for the name of a highly treasured plant, which we are calling... that's the reason they call it serviceberry? Now, serviceberry could well be one of the most valuable plants in anyone's backyard. Left to its own devices, it forms a multi-stemmed tree-sized shrub. If pruned early and often, it can be trained into a single trunk, making it a real tree. It is one of my favorite plants and part of one of my proudest moments. A decade or so ago, I was recruited by the Salvation Army to help design and build a large urban garden for their newest Croc Center, a series of safe places in dangerous and impoverished communities nationwide where local residents can come to exercise, meet, swim, enjoy healthy meals, and at this center, enjoy the fruits of a large urban garden. My challenge was located in one of the least served areas in North Philadelphia. I did not achieve the grand result by myself. Longtime organic farmer Sebastian Kermer, then associated with the original Whole Foods of Kimberton, and head of the cafeteria Glenn Bird, a very enthusiastic grower of as much of the food he could use as possible, were my wonderful co-conspirators, and the result was magical. More raised beds than I can remember that were immediately tended lovingly by local residents, a large greenhouse for raising our own starts, and an alley of serviceberry trees on land, that we legitimately had no claim on. These trees quickly matured and their spring blooms fed early to rise pollinators and then developed into serviceberries, an incredibly valuable fruit loved by birds and humans alike, producing the first native food of the season for a winter-weary audience. To anybody out there wishing to plant a native tree, I recommend serviceberry as my number 1 through 5 choices. Now, I had always assumed their common name came from their serviceability to humans and wildlife, but what I just read in Jessica Demaniano's weekly gardening column distributed by the AP made me rethink my assumption. She writes, quote, "Winters were brutal throughout most of New England in colonial America. Many settlers did not survive the season, But the colonists couldn't bury their dead because the ground was frozen solid. The settlers then watched one specific tree, known botanically as amelanchier, for cues. When its white flowers bloomed, it meant that the soil was soft enough to finally dig graves. Preachers then went from settlement to settlement to perform funeral services, earning the harbinger tree its common name of service, as in funeral service, bury. Or so the story goes. Okay, my mind is officially blown, but I urge you to plant service berry, if only for yourself, birds, and pollinators. Although the appearance of those flowers may signal that your garden soil is ready to be worked.
DIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here we go with another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later, there's nothing like having the satisfaction of bringing in the first major crop of the season before we teach you how to grow those peas. Number to call, 610-694-8100. Either listen to the prompts or go directly to extension number 3. And my producer, James, will get your call and will get you on the air. Like Diane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Diane. How are you?
We're very good. It's a little cold here today, but good time to start working on our beds.
Okay. Where are you located?
We're just right outside Nashville, Tennessee.
Excellent. Excellent. I can't tell you how much I enjoy being on the air in Nashville and Memphis. It makes me feel like a country music star.
Well, that's where we listen to you.
Yeah. Very good. What's the call letters?
WPLN.
All right. Shout out to them. What can we do you for, Diane?
Well, about 10 years ago, Mike helped me build 6 raised beds for my vegetable garden.
Excellent.
I've got 3 that are 4x4s and 3 that are 4x8.
Perfect.
Each year since then, I've added some compost, mostly like the black cow that I can get at Lowe's.
Stop. That's not compost. That is
manure.
That is composted cow manure from factory farms.
Ah.
No relationship to compost whatsoever.
So you don't recommend that, right?
Well, cow manure is interesting in that it is a very balanced level of nutrients compared to horse manure or poultry manure. But I worry about all the medications given to the animals in situations where it's easy to correct their waste. I've seen the product you talk about. I've never used it. And if you're not worried about the antibiotics and the growth regulators, nutritionally, it's balanced. But you used compost. Do you make your own compost?
No, I can't seem to get my compost bed hot enough to kill all the seeds.
Go online, buy a copy of my out-of-print book, which is available through secondary sources, Mike McGrath's Book of Compost. It will make you a master composter in one season.
Okay.
So how many bags of this dried cow manure are you adding?
Well, I've just added a few bags as I went along. I haven't added like a truckload of anything. Mostly, in the fall, I shred leaves and cover the beds with shredded leaves.
Okay, that is almost composting. Those leaves, as they break down, it's very wise to cover your beds over the winter and also to use shredded leaves to mulch in the growing season to prevent weeds. But so far, that's the best thing you're doing. Don't pull back on that. That's excellent. Now, did you have a question about the soil in your beds?
I do. After this amount of time, it's gotten compacted. I was surprised when I went to plant my fall vegetables how compacted the soil was. I could barely use my trowel to bust it up to plant my lettuce, and it's dropped. When I first built them, they were within an inch or so of the top of the bed, and now they're like 4 inches from the top of the bed.
Let me drop back for a second. When you first built them, what did you fill them with?
I filled them with, I have a nursery that's just down the street, and they have a raised bed soil. It's supposed to be topsoil, compost, soil conditioner, and sand.
Okay, that's good. Do you buy it in bulk?
Yes. We have a little trailer we can go get a scoop of it in.
Okay, I like that combination. And 10 years, you're right on the money. That's around the time, even though we don't step in our raised bed, gravity and the components shrinking will eventually make the soil compacted, even though we're not responsible. There's essentially one way to do this, but two methods. What you want to do is what we always advise not to do, but it's perfectly fine to do every 10 years, is go out there. If manual labor is your idea of a good time, you would double dig with a garden fork, which is as simple as using the fork to move the soil around and lighten it up. And I recommend that you get a big bag or two of perlite. It is a miracle soil conditioner. But don't buy the bag that says miracle because they've added chemical fertilizers to it. You just want regular perlite, which comes in huge bags, is very inexpensive. And you can show off to your neighbors because this bag, the size of a small child, weighs about 4 pounds. And you would mix.
So can I get that at most garden centers? Or?
Yeah, a garden center would be your best bet. You know, tell them you're looking for the big bag, the kind that farmers use. If they don't have it, find out where the nearest place is that farmers buy their supplies. So.
Okay.
You could also do this with a rototiller. Add the perlite as you go along. You will find by loosening the soil and adding the perlite, the soil level will rise. But very important, rake off the leaves first. You don't want to incorporate them deeply into the soil because that would be anaerobic. They wouldn't be getting any oxygen, and they could wind up stealing nitrogen from your plants. So you just want to rake off that material and do the soil lightening, whether you double dig or use a rototiller. But then comes the crucial part. Even in a raised bed garden, you're going to have weed seeds in that soil. And by turning the soil over, you will have exposed those seeds to sunlight, which is the trigger for germination. There used to be crazy gardeners who would only do this in the middle of the night under a non-moon so that no sunlight got through. That's a little excessive, although I do congratulate them. But what I suggest you do is when you're all done lightening up the soil, you level the bed perfectly, and then you water the holy heck out of them. 10 days later, at least in the spring, you'll see a bunch of unwanted plants pop up. So what you need then is a hoe with a very sharp blade, like a razor blade. Generically, they're called diamond hoes. I have no idea why. They have no relationship with diamonds. But you want a really sharp hoe. And what you're going to do is pull that hoe across the soil line, not digging into the soil, but you're going to chop their little heads off. By cutting out their greenery, they won't have any resources to sprout again. I mean, you know, one or two may come back, but you'll take care of 95%. And that's it. Now you're starting out with what farmers call a stale seed bed, meaning they've prevented overwintering weed seeds from taking over the plot.
Okay. I think I can do all that.
Oh, it's really not that difficult. And I would urge you, I know Tennessee, Nashville has a milder climate than I do, but I would urge you to do this early in the spring because you want it to be warm enough, oddly enough, to germinate those weed seeds. And then you put your plants in as the season allows and reuse those shredded leaves as mulch to keep down any new weeds.
Okay.
That's the whole shebang.
If I do all that, you're not thinking I'm going to have to top it off with any additional raised bed soil?
Well, without me seeing it, it's impossible to tell. But there would be no bad reason for you to have, you're buying it by the pickup truck?
Right.
Yeah, you would add some of that in with the perlite if you really have room to make up, and just pile the rest somewhere in the yard, and it will compost down into a single entity.
Okay.
All right?
So you're not, what I read about mushroom compost, I didn't, unless you had blueberries.
No, that's both totally incorrect. There's no correlation between mushroom soil and blueberries. And I have to be honest and say the explanation for both things, the soil needs of blueberries and mushroom soil, are complex, and they would require a whole question of the week or another phone call. But you don't need it, okay?
Okay, that's all I need to know.
Okay, all right, you take care and good luck.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there who endures a freezing winter to avoid rock salt, also known as sodium chloride and or NaCl, as this chemical wreaks havoc on plants, concrete, cars, and the overwintering creatures we're supposed to love. But don't go looking for an environmentally safe alternative just yet, because we'll be right back with a primer on growing your own spring peas and your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later, you really got to grow your own spring peas. There's nothing like having the satisfaction of bringing in the first major crop of the season, fresh and sweet, and you'll never go back. But we're going to go back to more of your phone calls and other nonsense. Number to call, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Emma, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Emma. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm just ducky. Thanks for asking. Where is Emma doing great?
Kutztown.
In Kutztown. Ring baloney once, ring baloney twice. Kutztown, Kutztown. Ain't that nice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great little town here in the Lehigh Valley. What can we do for Emma in Kutztown?
I was calling to see what your opinion was on starting tomato seeds inside. I have tried it a few times, but I always seem to be late. My tomatoes always seem to feel like they're ready for transplant in July.
Right.
And I never seem to time it right.
I have a kind of a unique system because I'm on the road most of February, you know, talking around the country. That's the big time for garden talks. So I never get an early start, but I make sure everything at home is set up. I have a nice, what's called a sterile mix, a soil-free mix, seed-starting soil. You never use any garden soil to start seeds in. You buy a professional mix. And the lighter the bag is, the better the results are going to be. And I assemble old six-packs from when I have bought plants in the past. You know, I know people like to start them in egg cartons or yogurt containers or stuff, but the six-packs, the plastic six-packs, are the best thing. That's why the professionals use them. And they are plastic, and they already exist. So the only way we can make their footprint less is to keep reusing them. And again, they do the perfect results. And right. I have my lights hung and ready. And then we do the Philadelphia Flower Show. And as soon as the flower show is over, which is generally around March 10th or March 11th, that's when I start my seeds. Because the basic rule of thumb is you want to put out transplants that are 6 to 8 weeks old when the nighttime temperatures are reliably in the 50s. Now, this is the tropical plants. This is melons, peppers, cucumbers, tomatoes. The early crops like lettuce and peas, they can go out super early. That's a whole other topic. But generally, I like to start my seeds 2 months before I anticipate putting them out. So for you, you know, you figure maybe May 15th, it's going to be warm enough at night to put them out safely. Maybe June 1st. So you start them around March 15th, and that's good. Now, that's more than 6 weeks, but you have to allow 7 to 10 days for germination. So what I do, and this is, you know, seed starting is much harder than gardening. It took me much longer to be a better seed starter than it did an outdoor gardener. So, for instance, if you're not good at it, don't be ashamed of buying your plants. You know, buy them from an organic farm or a local sustainable farmer. But if you want to do it, you need the professional supplies. You can't use garden soil. You can't use kindergarten tools like the egg cartons. You want to use the old six packs. Any gardener you know will have a million old six packs they'll be glad to lend you. So when you're ready and you got your seeds and your stuff all assembled, you fill the six packs with the soil-free mix, and then you sit them in water, maybe with a brick on top because they're going to just try to jump up and bend over. So keep them in the water until they're totally saturated, and then put them in something like a baking tray, something not a huge lip on it, but something that's going to hold the water that comes off, and assemble the six packs on this, and then sow two seeds in each cell. Don't sow the seeds and then try to put them in the water. That's going to be terrible. That's going to have a bad result. So you get the soil-free mix saturated first. You put two seeds in each cell, and then when you got everything set up, you put plastic wrap, like Saran wrap, over the top of everything. And now you don't need lights. You just need to have a heating pad underneath or keep them in a warm room and check them every day. When you see the very first sprout in any of the cells, take all the plastic off and get rid of it. And now they need to be under bright light. The easiest way to do this is with a simple shop light. 4 foot long, four foot long tubes and a 4 foot long fixture. You can get them real cheap at any home store. You can either use fluorescent tubes, which have improved tremendously over the year, or there's new age LEDs that fit the same fixtures. So I still use my old fluorescent lights because I bought a case of them. And the thing that people don't realize is you want the plants to be an inch or less away from the bulbs. If it's this far up, if it's like a foot up, they're not getting any of the light. The lumens decrease amazingly fast. But you keep them up close to the light, and the light won't burn them because fluorescents and LEDs are both cool. So you're not exposing them to heat or anything like that. So you continue to do this as the new sprouts come up. After they develop what's called their first true leaves, not the funny looking ones on the bottom, but the real leaves of the plant, then you want to go around to all of the cells and using a pair of scissors, you want to snip off the weakest looking one. That's the one in the cell. You got to plant two because sometimes you won't get full germination, but you can't grow two, or like when I started out, seven in one cell and hope for the best. And you don't want to pull it out because that'll disturb the roots of the other plant. You want to snip off the bad looking one, which is often the tallest one. You don't want tall. You want short and stocky. That's the healthiest plant. And that's always a measure of light. And then when you're about 3 weeks into your journey, you want to feed the plants with a very gentle dilute liquid fertilizer. You know, instead of watering regularly, once a week you want to water with a dilute solution of liquid fertilizer, but not fish fertilizer. I did that. My wife wanted to kill me. The house smelled like a fish hatchery for weeks afterwards.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so and then you continue to grow them up, moving the light up as they grow so that it's always close to the tops. Now, if you're growing peppers and tomatoes together, they're going to be different heights. Don't worry about that. Put the peppers up on books or something. But try to keep the tops of each plant up close to the light. And then really you're just waiting until the 10-day forecast doesn't show any cold nights. Ideally, every night is in the 50s. If there's a 49 in there and everything around it looks good, that's fine. People worry about the last frost date, but tomatoes and peppers are tropical plants. They have no sense of humor about nights in the 30s. Mm. And if you rush them, they'll be 2 or 3 weeks behind the ones that cowards planted on the first when the nights were reliably warm.
Okay.
And that's basically it. But the thing where people fail is the lights. You know, they think they can grow them in a sunny windowsill, and then they grow tomatoes that are 8 feet tall with two leaves on them as the plants desperately try to stretch towards the light that doesn't exist.
I've had that happen.
Yeah. So artificial light, it really doesn't cost anything. You get beautiful plants. And if you get good at this, swap up to a four-tube, four-foot-long fixture. Okay. Then your friends will ask you to grow their starts for them.
Awesome.
All right.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Good luck, Emma. 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Harry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Great, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Harry. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I'm in Tidewater, Virginia.
All right. What can we do for Harry in Tidewater?
Well, I have a crepe myrtle tree that we got from one of the Arbor Day things where they send you the little twigs. This thing has grown. It's the only one that survived out of the dozen or so that we got. It's I've added an addition to the garage. I need to move this thing, and now it's probably about 20 feet tall.
Ha! That's probably a record, because I know they can send out like 20 trees in a regular first class envelope.
I really like the tree too. My wife's in love with the tree since we grew it from just basically a little stick that came in the mail.
What color are the flowers?
Orangeish pink.
That's a nice shade for that tree.
Yeah.
And it's a solid tree form. It's not the multi-branching form.
No, it is a multi-branch.
Oh, okay. You know, most people do prune these trees back annually to try to keep them in a workable size. Did you say you want to move a 20-foot tree?
Yeah, it's the
are you a stockbroker?
No, but in Tidewater, I have lots of people with big equipment, so it's not I just want to make sure I can do it safely. The branches on this thing are about 2, maybe 3 inches around, and there's 5 or 6 of them.
Mm-hmm. It's the height.
Yes, it's the height.
It's the height.
They're very thin at the top.
It's the height.
Yeah.
For instance, have you ever bought a live Christmas tree as opposed to a cut one?
Yeah, it's been a few years, but yes.
Yeah. Do you remember how cut ones weigh about 7 pounds? And then you moved your lived one, and you realized the root ball weighed a couple of 100 pounds?
Right.
For you to successfully move this tree, you need a root ball the equivalent size, maybe 5 times larger than the old Christmas tree one. You need an enormous root ball. Now, I'm going to get you in trouble because I'm going to say this can be done.
Okay.
It has often been successfully done. If you've ever been to the Hearst Castle in Central California, all of the magnificent trees, as you climb up the slope to get to the mansion, they were all brought in full size, 30, 40, 50 feet.
Oh, wow.
Well, Hearst had more money than God. When God needed a loan,
right,
he went to Hearst,
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about. We're talking the equipment here is a giant scoop, kind of like an ice cream scoop, a cage that goes into the ground and lifts the root ball out of the ground. These are on trucks, often the size of a small crane. And
right,
obviously, as with a crane, they need room to move around. Now, when you take a tree down this size, you don't need that much sideways room because you're going to be cutting it down from the top and dropping down pieces at a time.
Yeah.
But, this is like a ladder. When you get the thing out of the ground, it has to be able to turn in all directions. So do you even have the clearance to do that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have plenty of room for that. And actually, I have a nursery right across the street.
They might have the right equipment. Do they sell mature trees?
It's not a retail nursery. It's a wholesale nursery. But I know the owner.
Okay.
I see lots of trees planted, nothing quite as big as ours. But so, you mean they would... If they've got the equipment, that would be the way to do it, have them come over and just scoop it right out of the ground?
Oh, yeah. Every year at the Philadelphia Flower Show, for instance, there's always a couple of really stately trees. I like to drop in during construction time, and you see these gigantic machines on the floor bringing in the trees. And again, the root ball is the size of an old Volkswagen. I mean... It is enormous. But again, it can be done. It is often done. People who are wealthy, who are creating a new home out of nothing, will often have mature trees brought in. And these have a pretty good survival rate. A professional is doing it. You'd want to do it in the winter when the tree is fully dormant. You'd want to do it during a cold stretch. You don't want it to warm up. during the transportation time. But this giant scoop would lift it up out of the ground, and then there would be an extension on the truck to lay the canopy down. And then they would drive it slowly over to the new hole, drop it in, get rid of anything they had wrapped around the root system to protect it during transport, and then backfill that hole with the same soil they took out. You never improved the soil in the planting hole.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask, if you did anything. Do you keep it watered even during winter?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. After transport, it is essential that anytime you don't get rain or snow during a week, that you let a hose drip at the base of that tree. But I mean drip, like an annoying sink.
Oh, okay.
For a solid 24 hours.
Okay, great.
Yeah, don't water it for half an hour and then stop. Really saturate the soil. And that's immediately after you move it, or in the first time, you know, that's not absolutely freezing outside. And then every week thereafter, if you don't get some rain or snow. And then again, especially in the spring, if things start to dry out, keep watering that tree as if it was a new tree, because it will be.
Oh, that's perfect. Good. I'm really happy that I can.
You're really going to do this?
I think so,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. We got to have pictures.
Okay.
We have to have pictures of this.
Okay, no problem.
All right. You got to, yeah, you'll be famous.
All right, great.
All right, good luck, Harry. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and inform everybody out there in the land of winter freezes that calcium chloride is the best ice melt for plants, concrete, and cars, not to mention it is the best de-icer at melting ice. You can't lose. Next up are magnesium chloride and combination products. But don't go doing the Snoopy Snow Dance just yet, because we'll be right back to help you enjoy delicious June peas this spring and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Fabulous Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. Can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me, as long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will implore you to grow your own peas this spring and educate you on the hows, whys, and wherefores, and all you need to do. But first, a couple, maybe one, maybe three, I don't know, of your fabulous phone calls. Our phone number, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Allison, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had, Allison. How you doing?
I'm great, and I just wanted to say I'm super excited to talk to you on the phone finally. I've been listening to your show since I was a little kid, and my dad played it in the car on long drives.
So. Oh, God, yeah. I apologize for that. a lot of parents tortured their children with NPR shows.
No, it wasn't so bad. I've gotten a lot of good things out of it.
All right. What can we do for you today?
Well, I wanted to ask you about cutting roots in houseplants. I always see suggestions that if you want to keep your plant in the same size pot or move it to a smaller pot, then you can just trim off like a third of the roots or something like that. And the few times that I've tried it, it's just been a long and torturous way to kill the plant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure that advice, if you know the name of the houseplant, please search root pruning and then what? Pachysandra, snake plant, whatever.
Okay.
And you should get some reasonable information about whether that's good to do or fatal.
Okay.
I'll tell you my rules. When I pot up my house plants and move them to a bigger container, I roll them out of the pot and then brush off all of the dirt. And I examine the roots carefully. If there's any rotting anywhere in the root system, you want to prune that off completely. When plants,
do you cut into the live section of the root, or do you want to cut below that?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, a basic rule, whether it's a diseased tree limb or something like that, is go into a little bit of the healthy part to make sure you get it off. But this is not a disease. This is a cultural problem, like opera. but unlike opera, there's a cure for this. And it's don't overwater your houseplants in the winter. Houseplants go dormant in the winter. They're not using a lot of energy. And most people, because they want to be good to their plants, water them much too frequently. For instance, I have a snake plant, also known as mother-in-law's tongue.
Yeah.
And I've had that since college. And 1 year, it got lost in a jungle of houseplants and didn't get watered for a year. And it was fine. It's
awesome.
Always easier to rejuvenate a dry plant than to bring a drowned one back to life.
Mm-hmm.
So now you got the roots. You're trimming off any rotten parts, and you're going to be sure not to overwater in the future. Oh. Again, because the plant's not using the water.
Okay.
And
is there any kind of like aftercare, like anything in particular, like wait to water it or anything like that that you should
do? I'll try and get to that.
Okay.
You also want to look for any roots that are not green and healthy, or that look different in a bad way from the other roots, and trim those off as well. Sometimes some of the roots will die of old age. So this is a great time to clean it up. But if nothing's wrong and you're putting it in a bigger pot to begin with, leave it alone.
Right.
The basic, almost always valuable garden advice is leave it alone. You know.
Yes.
So
I've learned that well from you.
now we got a healthy root system, and if you see anything use fresh potting soil in this case if you had to trim, just in case there was a disease present.
Okay.
And then put it in its new pot, and it's definitely going to be light now. So put it in a sink with a couple inches of water, leave it alone for an hour or two, lift it out, put it in the drain board until it stops leaking all over the place, and feel the weight of the pot. Okay? That's the weight at which you do not want to water. There's all sorts of these gadgets. Some really stupid advice is if the surface of the soil is dry, water it. No.
Okay.
The roots need to dry out. They don't.
Okay.
They don't want to be constantly wet, except for maybe lucky bamboo. So,
right.
You know, now you got the well-watered way to the pot. Put it in its final position, and you know, if you are a chronic overwaterer, yes, check it every week just to make yourself feel good. But don't water it every week. You want to wait to water until the pot feels light or you haven't overwatered yet and the plant is looking a little droopy. And then you want to water exactly the same way in the sink. Let it pull up the water through the drainage holes. Now it feels heavy. Let it drain. Put it back into place. Lather, rinse, repeat.
Okay, perfect.
All
I can
right.
Do that.
Well, thank
awesome.
You.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the question. You just saved thousands of houseplants.
Excellent. I've done my good deed for the day.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we're calling Peas, Please. They're the perfect cool weather crop. Part two of our organic solution to produce price inflation. Peas are my favorite cool weather crop. Crunchy, deliciously sweet, fun to grow, and kids love them. My pair of directly descended hooligans liked snow peas so much when they were growing up that there was little picking left for me to do, although sometimes they'd let me have a few every once in a while. Anyway, all types of peas are cool weather lovers. They are often called June peas because the vines typically shrivel up and die from the July heat. Peas are one of the few crops that also likes a sweet soil, which means slightly on the alkaline side. That's higher than 7 on the pH scale. Dusting a little ash from a hardwood stove in their planting lanes is a great idea, especially if you live in a climate that generally has acidic soil. Lots of rain equals lots of acidic soil. All peas have the ability to, quote, fix nitrogen from the air by way of a symbiotic relationship between their root system and specific strains of bacteria, providing free nitrogen to the plants for fast, strong growth. The right type of bacteria may already be in your garden, but using a fresh helping of, quote, pea and bean inoculant will greatly improve your harvest. This inoculant is widely available at independent garden centers and via seed catalogs, and it generally comes in the form of a powder containing a bacterium that is specific to peas and beans. Now, the timing of pea planting is crucial. The average days to harvest for most varieties is around 60 days. Cool climate gardeners will want to time their plantings to produce their first flush of sugary goodness around June 1st. That makes early April the ideal time to plant. Note, despite garden lore, it may not be lucky to plant your peas on St. Patrick's Day if you live in a mid-Atlantic type of climate, as St. Patrick's feast day falls on March 17th, and the soil may not be warm enough to allow nitrogen fixation. It may even be frozen solid. So wait until April 1st. No fooling. Types of peas. Snow peas, a favorite ingredient in salads and Chinese dishes that include mixed vegetables. You eat the slender treats, pod and all. Pick early and often. Don't let the seeds swell up inside the pod. And if you miss a few big ones, just zip the pods open and eat the peas inside. Early and frequent picking will maximize the flavor and increase the yield. Snap peas, a southern favorite. These are a bit larger than snow peas, but are still typically eaten pod and all after you snap off the top. Again, pick early and often, and just eat the peas inside if the pod starts to get tough after too much time on the vine. English shelling peas are left on the vine until the peas inside do swell up nicely. Then you zip open the pod and eat the tender and sweet peas inside. They taste great raw, but a springtime tradition is to cook them up with freshly picked scallions. You'll find hundreds of recipes online. Note, the heavily scented flowering plant commonly known as sweet pea is not edible. In fact, it is poisonous. Unfortunately, it also has some botanical features that resemble real edible pea plants. All true peas are edible, but ornamental sweet peas are not. You grow them for the flower and the fragrance. Almost all pea vines are, quote, self-supporting. Give them something to climb on, and their talented tendrils will take care of the rest. But how high, how tall does this support need to be? Dwarf snow peas, also known as bush types, can be very tiny depending on the variety. Even the shortest plants will produce full-size pods. Read seed packets and catalog descriptions carefully, looking for the final height of the plant. If that information isn't there, search the variety name at other sources. The same is true of snap and shelling peas. If the plant is supposed to get tall, grow it against fencing or a real trellis, which you can then reuse for pole beans after the peas are fried. True dwarf or bush varieties can get by with one of those tiny old-school tomato cages, but some shelling peas will require a tall trellis. No matter the type, pre-sprout your peas by soaking the seeds in water overnight and then wrapping them up in moist paper towels. Place them in Ziploc bags, but don't zip those bags shut or the peas inside may get moldy. Just leave them out at room temperature with the tops open and check daily to make sure the peas inside are still moist but not sopping wet. Give them a nice misting if the package is dry. When you see wiggly little sprouts, it's go time. Dig out lanes in a shape that will accommodate your trellises, dust some wood ash into the lanes, roll the damp seeds around in the inoculant, and drop them into the lanes a few inches apart. You can add more inoculant on top, but save some for your bean crops later on. Refill the lanes with the soil you removed, then spread an inch of compost over top for good luck. Don't add any nitrogen-rich fertilizer. Let the atmosphere handle that part. Well, those sure were some helpful hints for growing your own peas, now wasn't they? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive Question of the Week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to poach my peas if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts to reach You Bet Your Garden. or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming to our garden shore at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. No matter how you communicate, we really want to know your location. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created to meet a deadline for a tax break. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Check out her fine work and join our happy horticultural community at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our guardian angel is the lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the legendary awesome ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and now that I am finally finished planting next year's garlic crop, I'm ready to go back to shaking you upside down to see if any quarters for public radio come rolling out. Or you could just make a contribution to your local public radio station with a credit card and keep the quarters for parking meters.